And now, Chilpack Hollywood Hour with Dean Haglund and Phil Lairness.
Hi, everyone. I don't have to go into a long introduction because Garrett Wiley did it for us.
Thank you, Garrett.
Yes.
You are Dean Haglund.
I am Dean Haglund. You are Phil Lairness.
And we are coming from high atop the historic core of downtown Los Angeles.
I guess
in the Art Deco wonder that is the Eastern Columbia.
So we can keep that part.
Right.
Technically. The rest of it, we don't have to.
You don't have to repeat everything that Garrett says. Right.
Okay. It's just the, you know.
We can just get right into.
Because we get such a huge show on your Chilpack Hollywood Hour.
We,
I didn't have to say that.
We have indeed such a great show. And one of the reasons we say that it is your Chilpack Hollywood Hour is that we read, do we not?
All the time.
All the emails, comments, tweets, texts.
Everything.
Petitions. That are sent by our loyal, if not legion, then mighty listeners.
Mighty. Funny little pictures. We look at those too.
We got an email sent to us from Summer at Far Point Media.
Yay.
I just wanted to let everyone know that as of this week, the support.farpointmedia.net help desk system is being shut down.
Oh.
You will still be able to email requests and trouble reports to support@farpointmedia.net if need arises. Thank you, Summer Brooks. You know, Summer, this might be news to you, but y'all weren't offering help for many years, long before this.
You just had to open and unleash your barrels of wrath.
And that's why we left more than a year ago. So feel free to remove us from that email list.
Yep.
And it's also, I think, our leaving might have something to do with how you deleted everything from our website.
Not that you're bitter. This is what
including,
I like.
No,
your ability
I just
to let
to
stuff go.
Because people will ask, you know, are you ever going to make this show available? Is this show ever going to be available? Because, of course, we've done now more than 254 programs. I believe today is 255.
Right.
And only some of which are available. Many of which now. We've got probably more than 80 shows available.
Right.
But that still leaves more than a. I was told there'd be no math, but more than 170 that are not available.
Very good.
Slowly, we're bringing them back from the archives, and it is a painstaking process.
Yes.
And they're not available because the help desk, the helpful people at Far Point Media, deleted everything off our website on our way out the door.
Well, it was connected to their server, I suppose. Anyway, yes, it's funny that you should mention that we're still in the mailing list, but, you know, the help desk was unhelpful often. Summer was helpful, though. When you got her personally, she was helpful. No? I'm just looking for some positive.
You dealt with her. Yeah, absolutely. So we go from the story behind us going independent,
right,
breaking out on our own, do-it-yourself, maverick spirit that made podcasting great.
Yeah.
To historic, powerful, legendary bodies that helped make this industry great, merging together.
Oh, you're not talking Screen Actors Guild.
Screen Actors Guild and AFTRA. The SAG-AFTRA merger was approved.
Yeah.
And a raucous celebration of my dues going up.
Yay. And my dues
could be watched online. Did you? Yes. And a celebration,
dues,
I guess, of your dues going down.
Woohoo.
Bastard. Could be watched online. Did you watch it live online?
No, I did not. I was at the art gallery.
After about 35 minutes of it, an announcement not taking place, it was supposed to begin at 1 live. And indeed, the live feed began at 1. And there was one piano song that was played over and over and over again.
That's all they had the rights to. Think of how expensive that is.
And as our friend Jason Duplessis, one of the hosts of What Do They Said, tweeted, Shazam could not identify the song, which made him wonder, SAG-AFTRA, whether you had chosen non-union music.
Yeah.
I, of course, upon hearing that piano song over and over again, could only come to the conclusion that the neutral site that was found for a SAG-AFTRA announcement, whatever it might be, we didn't know at that point whether they were just announcing the election results or the voting results, that they had found as a neutral site was Nordstrom's near the escalator.
Which also...
That joke goes over huge in Europe and South America, where Nordstrom's...
Yeah. is so popular, and so is elevator music.
No, you know, they have the live piano player by the escalator at every Nordstrom's.
Joke. Oh, I see.
Yes. They also have favorite ever was when I went into a Nordstrom's once and the piano player was playing the theme from MASH, which everyone loves. Not a lot of people necessarily remember that it was introduced as a song in the original movie MASH by Robert Altman.
With lyrics,
yes. Of course, and the song is "Suicide is Painless."
Yeah, exactly. Which is what you want to hear.
Now go shop, people.
Huzzah.
I must say this though: after 35 minutes, when it finally at the 30-minute mark, someone stood up to the podium to announce quite dramatically that an announcement would be forthcoming.
Fantastic!
That was terrific.
Was that Tom Green doing?
When it finally got started, I must admit. You know, I can be jaded. I will admit to a certain cynicism.
Yes.
It was really quite moving.
What?
It really was quite moving. The raucous celebration was so overwhelming it terrified me a little bit. As the speakers went up there and you saw so many of the people who had worked so hard to make merger happen, both now and in the past.
Right.
Melissa Gilbert, former SAG president Melissa Gilbert, was
and
there.
Cookie Baker.
And when I saw her, you know, obviously the announcement had not been made yet, but when I saw her take the stage, I knew it could only mean one thing, that Melissa Gilbert has enough time on her hands to show up at this event.
Could it not be she's concerned about her
See, there's
union?
The jaded cynicism.
That's so jaded.
Was moving. It was emotional. Whatever side you came down on in terms of this merger or whether you couldn't decide at all, there was no denying again that these people that I was seeing were people of fine character and integrity who had really sacrificed a lot
to do this,
to put into this work.
Right.
And for them, yes, by all means, have a moment to feel that emotion,
because I'm sure the behind
comes
this
from working so hard on anything.
Absolutely, and this has been years. I mean, since the '90s, there's been talk, even earlier, of the mergers happening. And I would think that if anybody had been there through all of that to have this day come, would be like being released from some sort of prison.
And I watched the night before a local news station did an interview with the leading figures in the lawsuit that was filed to try to block the merger vote from happening, which was dismissed with prejudice, actually. Yeah. And you know, Ed Harris, Ed Asner, all the Eds.
All the Eds was against him. Ed Helms?
I don't know.
That's all the Eds I know, actually.
And so there were several actors, and they met in a park over in Beverly Hills where I think we weren't allowed to shoot, if I'm not mistaken.
Is that right?
But, and they were interviewed, and the anger that more often than not became really mean-spirited that was expressed by these people was telling to me.
Anger towards the merger?
The merger and towards the people promoting merger. And when Ed Asner is introduced in a video, an anti-merger video, and his message, and I'm not making this up, he's introduced as former SAG president Ed Asner.
Right.
And he says, I am not opposed to merger.
Okay.
I am not opposed to merger in the future.
Uh-huh.
This merger sucks. Those are his words.
And I'm
relieved that that kind of rhetoric did not take the day.
Right.
You know, we had contributions from our friend David Soboloff that were thoughtful.
Right. And constructive and helpful. in guiding a decision.
So those people who were against merger and those people who, again, didn't know and maybe didn't even vote because they still could not decide where they came down on it, I don't think were well served by the people spearheading the no on merger vote. With that kind of atmosphere, especially because, again, as we talked about before, it has now passed. For this to work, it would be helpful if everyone who has passion and skin in the game contributed their best ideas.
Absolutely.
And expressed them in the best way possible, communicated them in the best way possible.
Right. Instead of trying to derail the damn thing, make it work so that everybody is happy with it in whatever capacity is possible.
So,
I agree.
Anyway, the votes were, of course, overwhelming. 86% of AFTRA voted in favor, and 82% of those votes cast from Screen Actors Guild member in favor. So merger passed, and hopefully that means we won't have to talk about merger for a little while on the show.
That'd be awesome. And, you know, that's more than actually voting for presidents ever get in 80.
Oh, of course. And there was a bigger turnout, actually, in votes. You know, you hope for 50% turnout in a presidential election, and the turnout was greater in terms of the amount of ballots cast in this sort of
it's a big deal.
Election. So...
Now development news. Oh, no.
No. I don't think we'll get time for that either. But we are going to include it in this week's
bonus?
Movie Lovers Companion.
Okay, very good.
This week we'll be publishing the third Movie Lovers Companion in our blog.
I just like to point out...
And we'll be discussing in it...
It's been a month.
The development
You've been,
news.
Like, teasing
right.
development
news. We have
news.
So much other great stuff. We were at a screening.
Yes, we were.
Of The Truth Is Out There, Dinner and a Movie screening.
Delicious.
At Marika Live in Studio City, the organic watering hole.
How about that chocolate?
The sipping chocolate, the Marie Antoinette. I'm still high as a kite.
I know, me too.
From that. It was a lot of fun. Film was well received. Great, great space. And so much fun getting to see our friend James Kerwin.
James Kerwin was there.
Whose film, Yesterday Was a Lie, I think, ought to play
there as well.
And by the way, our friend James Kerwin, later in the show, we'll talk about Live Event of the Week.
Which we're going.
Our friend James Kerwin is directing for One Night Only, a world premiere show at the Blank Theater.
Guess what I put in my calendar?
I have no idea.
Going to that.
I'm hoping it has something to do with James Kerwin.
Yes, it does, specifically.
Excellent.
Yeah.
Pretty soon you'll be putting in your calendar... Twin Peaks pilot viewing. We'll talk about that later.
I might erase that.
How much fun for me, anyway?
Was it fun
for
you?
You had at least met Karen before, but getting to meet our longtime listeners and friends, Karen Davila and Chelsea Ray.
Yes, they were
hanging
delightful.
Out. That was so much fun. And, of course, we've talked about Karen on the show before because she wrote a question once about casting directors.
Yes.
That we discussed on the show. And that is her ambition, is to get into casting.
Right.
And it's, of course, very difficult.
Yes.
Field to get into, as is anything in the business. It's also difficult because there's no one who tells you exactly this is how you do it.
Right.
And how do you start at the ground floor?
And then work your way up.
Especially when there's so many people with resumes
doing
of
it.
Experience, trying to get in at the ground
right,
floor.
Right, exactly.
And I had suggested to her, again, apropos of Live Events of the Week...
Very good.
...that she might want to contact theater companies and say, hey, I would like to volunteer to help in casting.
Lovely idea.
They have casting directors hired. I can't believe that a lot of people are flocking with their resumes to apply for unpaid positions in theater companies.
Right.
And I said, this is great because you will get known by casting directors. You will get experience that way. You will also meet actors, many of whom are struggling actors, some of whom are quite recognizable actors. Because as we've said,
there's a lot of theater
in
going
there. L.A., theater in L.A., many, many shows feature beloved, recognizable performers. So you'll get to meet actors that way. And that's the other part of gaining the experience, is actually getting to interact with actors.
Right.
And forming a relationship there. So that was my advice to her in the moment.
Very good.
I think it might have been unsolicited advice. But I just asked her how it was going, because she's out of school now. And,
right.
And I take an interest.
Perhaps as you
and,
do.
And what I did not say to her, and hopefully she will listen to this show, and so I can address this to her and to everyone. you know, I once got a wonderful piece of advice, which was just the insight that there will never be, we've talked about this before, there may not be any longer a demand for movies. There might not be a demand for television. We have enough, and we have access to all of it.
Absolutely. Right?
There might be demand for certain brands or certain franchises, but just the idea, we don't need any more.
Right.
We have access to all of it.
Murder, She Wrote is entertaining me very well these days. Thank you very much.
There will never be too many people creating beautiful things.
Right.
However,
that's true.
There will always be a shortage of people dedicating their lives to creating beautiful things. And I also, my corollary now to that bit of advice that was once given me is there will never be too many people doing what they love.
Ah, interesting.
Right. That's true. Will always be a shortage of that.
People doing what they love.
So if that is what you love and you know that pursuing it, you know, then pursue it. Find a way to pursue it. And again, get creative with how you pursue it. But if it is what you love, then absolutely do, and know that that love is going to lead you exactly where you were meant to be. It might lead you into another direction altogether,
right,
but you will get there time and time again by pursuing what you loved. The other aspect of that is, in terms of doing what you love, is not just saying, oh, I don't love what I'm doing right now, how can I pursue what I love? But also, how can I love what I am doing right now?
Right.
How can I connect as deeply as possible with what I have in front of me at this moment?
To make it as satisfying as possible.
Right. And those, I think, more often than not, the people who are capable of doing that are the people in any field with whom you want to work.
Yeah. That's
you
true.
Want to surround yourself with those people.
That has that level of satisfaction, right, and not being pissed off
and not wanting to be somewhere else and not being somewhere else.
Right, checking
mentally
out.
Mentally or emotionally or whatever.
All of that. You I know, hate that.
Right. Yeah, someone who acknowledges that if they've said they will do a job, that job will be very important to them.
You're right. And not do it begrudgingly. Begrudging right. is the key word. There's a lot of begrudging going on these days.
Right. Absolutely. And there may always be. So again, whether it be pursuing what you love or finding a way to love what you're doing, connect as deeply with it as possible, there will always be a shortage of people doing both of those things. And if you are the sort of person that does those things, it will recommend you greatly to the people all around you.
That's advice that spans all the fields.
That's, well, good.
That is, yeah.
See, we're off
there
to a
go.
Great start.
There you go. Awesome.
I wanted to follow up on a news story that was written to us from John Giroto last week about impending demolition of Pickfair Studios.
And I received the protest demo info a little late, so I didn't get to make it. Yesterday, April 1st, there was a demonstration to prevent the destruction of the Pickfair Writing Building. And
apparently there's very little that can be done because the permits have already been issued.
Right.
However, as we know, sometimes enough bad publicity can stop something.
Something.
I, instead of addressing the latest on that issue, wanted to share with you, because you're such a lover of the history, especially the history of cinema
right.
and film, a couple of really cool pieces that I learned about Pickfair that you may not know.
Oh, wow. Hit me.
Eccentric billionaire, which is sort of isn't that just...
Yes.
redundant.
Howard Hughes. I did know this. But go ahead. Tell everyone.
He kept an office at the studio.
Yes.
During his movie-making days.
What else did he keep there?
Oh, I don't know.
In the fridge?
This is going to be some conspiracy theory.
No.
Can I tell you the truth before you get to me about some rumor?
Okay.
He had a secret garage on Pickfair Studio that he could wheel into directly off Santa Monica Boulevard.
Whoa. Awesome.
Now think about the geography there.
Yeah.
Pickfair does not come down
Santa Monica.
It's off Fountain, right?
Yeah. No. Wait a sec. Fountain.
Right, Formosa Fountain, or is it Santa Monica?
It is Santa
Monica. No.
That's not Santa Monica. Because La Brea and Santa Monica is
Our geography is fell off. But the point is, he had a private
entrance
garage that he could enter off of Santa Monica Boulevard. Yes. Just him.
Just him. Totally top secret.
So what did he have in the freezer?
Well, he didn't leave that bungalow for 4.5 months when that disease started, where you are fearing germs and everything like that. So
there's scenes of this, of him holed up in a screening room.
Yeah.
When the head of Pan Am, played by Alec Baldwin, visits him.
Yes.
In
And that's it. That's there.
The Aviator.
Yeah. And that's where he first started, you know, that mental illness of whatever he had, whatever that was called, where it was everything was draped. And part of that was not using the toilet. And so it didn't smell. He kept everything in the fridge. That's
I awful. Have been I to know. Plenty of screenings that have threatened my mental stability. Not the least of which, of course, was Mirror Mirror, which we talked about before.
You know who else had a bungalow there? Frank Sinatra. That's one of the ones they'll be tearing down as well.
Well, director Sam Peckinpah not only worked at the lot, but that was his residence throughout the 1970s.
Oh, I didn't know that. Oh, he stayed there.
Isn't that great?
That is great.
Sam had a suite on the ground floor at the writer's building right down the corridor from Mike Medavoy's office.
Oh, my gosh.
Recalled producer Kathy Haber, who worked with Peckinpah on 8 feature films at the studio. Mm. He used one of the rooms as his bedroom.
Wow, of course, because he'd be editing all night, I'm sure. Well, see, now here's this thing. I don't understand why this building isn't on the National Historic Registry and therefore protected by these kind of destruction building permits that could just willy-nilly come and tear it down. I mean, it seems to me that being on the National Historic Registry gives you all sorts of tax benefits, helps tourism, and for whoever company bought this and then deciding to tear it down and put up an office building seems to be very short-sighted, in my opinion.
We've teased at it long enough with Marika Live, with James Kerwin in the Blank Theater.
Oh.
Let's get it started. It's the live event of the week.
The Chilpack Hollywood live event of the week.
Hooray!
My live event this week.
Yes.
For the first time ever, I saw a production of Phantom of the Opera.
Wait a sec. You went and saw Phantom of the Opera as done by Andrew Lloyd Webber?
Andrew Lloyd Webber's Phantom of the Opera.
With the full chandelier coming down on the hydraulic swing lift thing?
The chandelier was underwhelming. It was a high school production of Phantom of the Opera.
Awesome.
At St. Francis High School,
uh-huh.
La Cañada, Flint Ridge area.
Fantastic.
So inspiring.
Really?
I go occasionally to high school productions there. And I'll be the first to say when they are not good. This was good on a professional level.
No.
And all the more inspiring because it was high school students.
Yeah.
Unbelievable. The women in the show, especially the young girls in the show. Incredible.
Incredible singers.
The chandelier effect was underwhelming.
What did they do? Was it paper mache?
No, it was a real chandelier. They couldn't do what I'd always heard about. But again, I've never seen a production.
All right.
Crashing down suddenly and surprisingly on the audience.
Right.
This was a bit slow. And
squeaker, squeaker, yeah. Squeaker. Mm.
That was one of the only little misgivings that I had about the production. This was incredible. And I've also got to tell you, I wouldn't care to see this production by anyone other than high school students.
Well, frankly,
it's actually cool done by young people.
Yeah. Because the emotions
by
were overwrought.
By grown-ups?
It seems childish.
It's sort of ridiculous.
Which is what I thought when I saw the damn thing. That was the thing, is that this was a ridiculous thing that I could see very well suited to a high school.
I was realizing that it was 10 years ago, in June or July, I believe, that I was working with the Cappies, the award-winning high school theater students.
Oh, yes, of course.
From around the country.
Yeah, yeah.
One of whom is John Lawler, the singer-songwriter of the B-Film Extras, who do the theme song to Truth Is Out There.
There you go.
And 10 years ago. And
that's
so,
a lifetime.
Kind of cool. 10 years later, I'm still being inspired by the work of high school students.
See?
And there is some incredible work. So that was my live event of the week.
That's lovely. Because there's so many, you know, kids aren't jaded at that point. So they're still loving the emotional ups and downs of an Andrew Lloyd Webber musical. Delightful.
Our live event of the week segues quite wonderfully this week into another segment that we do on this show.
Yes.
The Chill Pack Hollywood Lawsuit of the Week.
Indeed, this week's lawsuit comes to us courtesy of the playwright from one of last week's live events, John Patrick Shanley.
Oh.
Playwright.
Yes.
Of Danny and the Deep Blue Sea.
Danny and the Deep Blue Sea.
We saw last week.
Absolutely.
61-year-old John Patrick Shanley is being sued for $5 million.
Ouch.
By a 26-year-old former lover who alleges sexual violence during their four-month relationship.
What?
Right. There are several different places I want to go with this. First, yeah. I want to acknowledge, because we haven't yet, congratulations to Dick Van Dyke, 81 years old, for finding true love in his nuptials with his 26-year-old makeup artist. As one comic tweeted, 81-year-old Dick Van Dyke marrying his 26-year-old makeup artist is not a marriage, it's a kidnapping. This, though, an acceptable age difference, 61-year-old John Patrick Shanley and a 26-year-old lover.
Right.
Who is suing him?
Okay.
All right.
So,
where do you want me to begin with this?
How about your violence prevention specialist?
Yes,
Mitch?
Let's go with this angle. The details in the complaint are juicy. Of course, what this violence is. I'm not even going to address them. People can look those up. And who cares? In a sense, who cares? They are released, no doubt, as part of the lawsuit publicly.
Right.
To try to already sway public opinion. Again, perhaps to pressure Shanley's side into settling because the bad publicity. However, the issue comes down to, were these acts consensual? Were they not? So it doesn't matter what the acts were.
Right.
You know, when we're doing violence prevention work and we're talking about sexual violence, we are never talking about rough sex.
Right.
We are talking about consent.
Consent. So
was consent given and was consent informed? A 15-year-old cannot give consent.
Right.
They are not at the age of consent.
Right.
Someone who is under the influence of alcohol cannot give consent.
Right.
If you have sexual relations with someone who was drunk and the next day or a week later or a month later they feel
violated,
that they were violated, they have a case.
Right.
Because they were not capable of giving consent.
Okay. But you would think after 4 months, somewhere in there, 4 months.
4 month relationship.
So he had the ability to give consent somewhere.
I am not speaking as any representative of any feminist group or as any violence prevention group. I am speaking as Phil Lernis, your friend in podcasting. I have a bit of a problem with this going to civil lawsuit.
Oh, civil.
Either without or before any kind of criminal complaint
right.
is filed. If consent was not given, this is a crime.
Right.
Now, we're in a situation involving our own potential lawsuit where we might be seeking satisfaction through criminal charges and through civil
right.
charges.
Right.
There is no estoppel conflict in terms of what we're pursuing. For something like this, I do understand a civil complaint is easier to prove.
Right. The burden of proof
is much lighter.
Right.
It's 51%.
Right.
Versus a preponderance of the evidence versus beyond reasonable doubt.
Right.
A crime was committed if consent was not given.
Right.
Or if consent was withdrawn. Again, this is a very important thing. Consent can be given and can be withdrawn.
Right.
Moment by moment.
Okay, so after 4 months, can I withdraw?
After 4 months, this does.
Can I withdraw consent 4 months later?
Now,
or
if
4 months
we are to
after.
Learn, this is where we're, you know, we have to be careful again because these battles are waged publicly.
Right.
All too much.
Right.
And waged by lawyers who have, again, skin in the game.
Right, yeah.
We don't know the nature of the relationship outside the bedroom in terms of, was there pressure on her to be in that relationship in the first place?
Right.
Of a financial nature, of a career nature.
What was he?
She is an independent film actress.
Okay.
We don't know any of those things that went into it. There could have been a pattern of manipulation. There could have been a pattern of abuse. There could have been these things. I do, again, have misgivings that these things will not be investigated
criminally.
But instead, they will need to be proven
civilly, which then is less. So it seems to me that there's, I mean, when you go to civil,
I don't
like
think that.
Money.
I mean, I just, again, speaking just as an individual, if the person did something wrong, the person you maybe ought to be punished, and also a crime should be prosecuted. Also, because if we're going to have a system of justice and we're going to have criminal sentences, I would think part of that is because you want to deter similar behavior.
Right. Still,
John Patrick Shanley might have the money for such a civil settlement of $5 million. Someone who doesn't have the money to lose might say, oh, well,
I'll sue.
Or I don't even have the money.
Right.
So I may behave that way.
No, that's true.
The only problem John Patrick Shanley had was he didn't hide his assets.
Keep his assets in his pants.
So we will keep an eye on this, again, from the violence prevention standpoint. But it does make me uncomfortable.
Yeah, well, and I'm uncomfortable just with
that. And I'm uncomfortable also because these are hard enough cases.
Yes.
To
deal with when it's in a
to try to prove people who are truly survivors of sexual violence or relationship violence are incredibly courageous to come forward.
Absolutely.
To press charges. It's very difficult. And if this is some sort of ploy to make a name, to get publicity, to get money, it makes it all the harder on people
to come forward in the future.
Crimes like these are the most underreported crimes.
Right.
We shouldn't even allow ourselves to go to that reaction of, oh, she's just after something.
Right.
Which is so often the public defense, because these are incredibly underreported crimes. So it happens much more than we're ever allowed to know about.
Right, of course.
So that's the truth of it. People are less likely to pursue claims even when they are survivors of this. And again, all the more reason why those very rare instances where it is being used as a tool, I've learned in my past before, but people who really, you know, on film sets where sexual harassment runs rampant.
Right.
And people were willing to file sexual harassment charges against someone because of something else they were doing that was unethical, illegal, what have you.
Inappropriate.
The one thing this person, in one example I'm thinking of, was not guilty of was sexual harassment.
Right.
So don't use that claim. Don't falsely claim that. There's too many people who have that experience happen to them and can't bring those claims or can't bring those claims to fruition.
So right.
Those are my misgivings.
Wow. We'll follow that.
One other lawsuit that I just thought you might get a kick out of.
I obviously do.
Because this
get
is
a
all about just vanity and ego of show business. Uwe Boll, arguably the worst
director.
Living filmmaker,
the luckiest
of all time.
Man. He bought the video rights, the movie rights to a bunch of video games early on before anybody thought of doing that, and then went and directed them all into the mud in a hole in the ground. That was sadly, I think he does all Resident Evil. Anyway, he's the ongoing joke in the directing world. What's his?
He is being sued. I want to find this amount. He is being sued for $1 million by a producer who alleges that Boll intentionally misspelled this producer's name in credits out of spite.
That's awesome.
One letter is wrong in the producer's name, and he's convinced that Bull did it intentionally out of spite. So $1 million.
Seeing Bull's movies, I don't think he can micromanage to that small a degree. I mean, I don't think he's got that kind of eye for detail.
That's funny. You bring forward his films, his collected works, as evidence for the defense in the
That's
case.
Right. Clearly he has no eye.
Not since former baseball great Pedro Guerrero's trial on drug trafficking charges, where he was under charges of being some kind of drug kingpin. And the defense in that case was he's too stupid to arrange anything. That's indeed, they used his IQ, right, which was supposedly incredibly
I'm
low.
Sure, there's a bunch
but
of witnesses.
My favorite part of the defense, yeah, and I'm not making this up, they used as examples tasks that are beyond Pedro Guerrero. Simply because he could see ball, hit ball, did not mean that he's capable of much more than that. And right, one of the tasks that they said he was incapable of performing, as to show that he could not arrange a drug deal, making his bed. He could not
make a bed.
Master the skills involved in making a bed. And I mean, I had a field day with
That's
that,
awesome,
wanting to know, like, what part was it that challenged him?
Right.
Was he trying to make it with himself still in it?
And did the lawyer stand around watching him trying to make a bed? How did they all have the proof of this as well?
All right.
So hilarious.
We've done as a collective resolution each week what we're reading. I don't think we're on to any new stuff, probably. We're both still working.
Yes.
So I thought we would talk about, well, I did have a discovery, as I shared with you, about the John Adams book.
Oh, yes. There's a period.
I've been calling it John Adams, and really the name of the book is John Adams, period. I'm more than halfway through the book before I realized on the cover it's John Adams, period.
That's essential.
Because John Adams always signed his name with a period after it, which I love. So I'm now starting to do that.
Yes, Phil Lernis, period.
And I'm also starting, as you know, to write my daily to-do lists left-handed.
Ah, very good. That's right. We did have this conversation.
Because I
realized
notoriously illegible writing.
Yes.
And I learned through a process of tests that I am left-handed, even though I have acted right-handed all my life, with the exception of baseball. Getting back to baseball,
yeah,
two baseball references in one show.
Look at us go! We should be
spring training just ended this weekend. So how? What could be more appropriate in terms of celebrating the national pastime? So it turns out that I'm left-handed, trained to write right-handed, though trained to write just illegibly right-handed.
Right.
How illegibly? I hear you ask, and I told you this story.
Tell us.
There was one word on my to-do list that I could not read. I could not make out for the life of me what I was supposed to
Your
be doing.
Your own handwriting.
My own handwriting.
Right.
So finally, in an effort to discover what that word was, I decided to copy by hand that word from one sheet to the other, just trying to imitate my own writing. My illegible imitation of that illegible word was such an illegible imitation that the word now became perfectly legible.
You're your own Navajo wind talker. I can't believe
it. I'll let you check this out. This is, of course, a traditional to-do list.
Right, and I can barely read that.
And this is my first ever left-handed to-do list.
Now look at that. That is awesome.
It's shaky.
It's shaky, but that's just...
And it's legible, because I haven't developed the muscle coordination yet.
But
and it's legible, isn't it?
Far more legible than your right-handed one. That is insane. And the ink is pressed harder. I mean, all of it, it seems... And it's straighter, too. Look at you keep your... Oh, my gosh.
There is a book, a series of books that I want to speak about.
Left-handed.
In honor of our
New
tradition
leaf.
Of talking about what we're reading. We are not reading these, though the rest of the world is. We probably haven't even seen the film based on the first book.
Nope.
The rest of the world has. I'm talking about The Hunger Games.
Yes.
There is a ridiculous conspiracy theory surrounding The Hunger Games. That of which our producer Lyle Scozzi is quite fond of and a proponent of, but it's the idea that Suzanne Collins, the author of the Hunger Games books, ripped off the 1999 novel by Kushan Takami.
Right.
Battle Royale,
and it's the same kind of movie.
One of the first people to come to Suzanne Collins' defense and saying, you know, they're not really that similar is Stephen King.
Right, because...
Who, oh, by the way, has always charged Takami with ripping off his books, Running Man and The Long Walk, in writing Battle Royale.
Right.
And how about, oh, by the way, The Most Dangerous Game?
Yeah, wasn't that?
Or both authors avowed inspiration, Julius Caesar.
Julius Caesar, Shakespeare?
Yes.
Wow.
So where do we begin?
Where do we begin?
With this and the acknowledged influences. How about we begin with it ignores all reality about, first of all, the zeitgeist.
Right.
About the fact that artists go into the subconscious, go into the collective unconscious to pull stories forth. They exist in that unconscious. They don't exist within a person.
Right.
We go in and tap into something that is there, which means quite likely there are other people doing the same. Many people are thinking about these issues.
Right.
In order that it is there to tap into in the first place.
Yeah.
So multiple artists will tell similar stories from different perspectives, i.e. their own perspective.
Absolutely. And over a span of 10 years.
And it also is to ignore the fact that when Suzanne Collins pitched this story, the publisher said, oh, that's interesting. It is similar to this book Battle Royale. And she said, oh, should I read that then to make sure
it's not the
that
same?
It's not. And they said, no, whatever you do, do not, because we don't want that in your head.
Right.
Much the same way as Making the Truth is Out There.
Right.
We did not watch other conspiracy films. Are there similarities between ours and theirs? How could there not be?
Absolutely.
But indeed, we did not want to be in our head about whether something was too similar or not similar enough or any of those sort of things.
Absolutely.
We had a story to tell.
Yeah. And that's what you do. You tell a story from your headspace.
And what's interesting about this with the Hunger Games and the ignoring of the zeitgeist, ignoring
yes.
how the psyche, the consciousness, the creative
how writers
spirit
write.
All work, how writers write, it's the kind of sloppy thinking to me that leads to several conspiracy theories that we've encountered.
Right.
It just our own lack of understanding
of how
gets projected outward. It's also interesting, is it not, like we were talking about, it's only ever hugely successful works
yeah,
that
that's
get
right.
these charges.
Yeah. What about that?
Could that have anything to do with our own frustration over someone else having that kind of success?
Right. So I wrote the same thing. Yeah.
Outward.
Exactly. I think about when I was on the X-Files.
It also is to deny accomplishment.
Right.
Again, like so many conspiracy theories, it's that great accomplishment has to be torn down.
Right. That it can't be done. It has to be aliens building the pyramids.
Because if we believed that great accomplishments were possible, then we're responsible for trying to attempt something great ourselves.
That's right. Like teleportation.
Indeed.
I'm like, just saying that that's, you know, it's theoretically possible.
People are fundamentally the same. We are constantly approaching the same topics, the same questions
yes.
about what it means to be human beings. How do we live lives under the circumstances in which we find ourselves? What does it mean to live those lives? How can we improve those lives? We're constantly asking the same questions. And how could we not be asking fundamentally the same questions, no matter where we are on this
right.
globe? When we are, I love this stat. We are 99.9% the same from a DNA standpoint. 99.9. You, me, everyone on the planet.
Right.
No matter background. No matter geographic location, 99.9%, not only of the same matter, but of the same sequencing,
right.
99.9%. So our differences are 0.1%.
Right.
So naturally, we are going to be coming up with stories that are quite similar.
It's in our DNA.
Right. And so instead of arguing over our differences, or arguing over how similar we are, which is in this case, how about celebrating the differences?
Absolutely.
Because within the way that things are different, that's how the unique perspective of people, and in this case, authors, can truly be celebrated.
Right. Though in that respect, we also share 50% of the DNA with bananas. So, I mean,
bananas may have the same consciousness to a certain degree that we do.
So I suggest writers write for bananas instead of other people. That's how you get out of these
Well,
lessons.
They're certainly not getting paid, so maybe they are writing for bananas. And maybe that's the reason that there's frustration towards Suzanne Collins, who's making actual
see?
Do-re-mi.
There you go. Full circle.
But I mean, you think in other fields, not just in terms of novels, by this kind of thinking, every single Western ever made is a ripoff of every other Western
right.
ever made.
That's true.
In fact, artists,
genres.
Artists know throughout the ages that if you disagree with another artist in terms of their philosophy or in terms of their approach or in terms of their themes, you don't write an essay about it. You don't talk about it. You do your own version of the same theme,
right.
of the same story. You approach it from your own perspective.
High noon in Rio Grande,
instead of getting
right?
into a debate or an argument about it.
Right.
Right? Tell That's a better right. story.
That seems obvious.
And so again, it's the idea of this ripoff. I one of the words on this that I think is so interesting to me is from John Sayles, the great independent filmmaker,
uh-huh.
who when asked how he felt about the similarities, the incredible similarities between his Return of the Secaucus 7
yes.
and the eminently more successful and less interesting Big Chill.
Big Chill, yeah.
He knew that, one, calling it a ripoff would be ludicrous.
Uh-huh.
Because they were both, Lawrence Kasdan and him, children of the same age.
Of course.
Dealing with the same issues.
Same
and
issues.
Two, the similarities themselves would help ensure that his smaller, darker, and therefore less successful, though again, from my standpoint, more interesting work, would never be forgotten. It made more money because someone else had, on a larger canvas, dealt
right.
with the same issues.
Ha. Now, there's a nice open approach to that sort of thing. Instead of going, those bastards, you're never going to have even if you have
Boy,
a
the
original.
Way those guys that wrote the Bible ripped off other creation myths. Boy, the way
yeah.
the Quran or the Torah ripped off
the other stories. Yeah.
yeah.
That's the thing. Your stories have to resonate with people, and all of us have an ingrained need not to hear stories, but also to tell stories. So invariably, absolutely, we all come from the same human experience. We're going to tell similar stories, hopefully.
And so this idea of saying, oh, well, that shouldn't be loved as much because it's a ripoff. Well, this gets back to one of our questions, even about actual forgeries of artworks. Are
right.
they no less a work of art?
Right. And
if they move people, and if they have great meaning for the people who have the forgery,
right?
Well, then it's no less an icon.
That's true. In fact,
and this idea of calling something a ripoff because it's successful is so boring. Celebrate storytelling.
Exactly.
If there is another work that deals with similar issues and maybe deals with them in a better way. Well, I got to tell you, I think a lot of people who are jumping on this bandwagon, again, it's resentment, it's jealousy, it's insecurity,
mm-hmm.
and there are people who haven't read the original book, Battle Royale.
Right.
Maybe saw the movie. But
right.
people don't read a lot anyway. So, but if you really think that, oh, these are incredibly similar, well, then champion the book that you love.
Right.
And go to people... You like Hunger Games? You like, read this.
Right.
This deals with a lot of similar themes, and it's even cooler in this sort of way.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Do that. Celebrate it. You like spaghetti westerns by Sergio Leone? Oh, my God. Watch these. Watch these Kurosawa films.
Watch these, yeah. These
upon which, you know, they were ones. The influence. Watch these. Oh, you like Kurosawa films? Watch the westerns of John Ford.
Right.
You know, you'll love this. You'll love this piece of it.
Yeah, yeah.
Open people to more stuff. That's how you share something you love.
Right.
This gets back again almost to the conversation we had at the beginning about communicating your message. If your message is about how much you love the Screen Actors Guild and want to fight for the Screen Actors Guild, then your communication ought to be one of love.
Right.
Not one of anger and meanness. if your communication is you love Battle Royale and you wish more people who are flocking to see the Hunger Games would read that book to reward that author for his great work, well, then champion that book. Yeah. You champion nothing by trying to tear something else down.
Well said.
The Chilpack Hollywood Explanation of the Week.
I'm going to tell a story, Dean Haglund, and you are going to then answer a question about how this story indicates the way in which knowledge is lost. And I will then take the counterpoint to indicate the way in which it prevents knowledge from being lost. It's a Dean Haglund, Phil Larenas point counterpoint. Here, my friend.
What if I get it wrong? I don't think I'm.
No, you won't. You know this story.
Oh, okay.
So I decided to write it in very simple, easy to follow storytelling terms.
Just the way I like it.
It's the story of Edmund Kean's sword.
Very nice.
Great contemporary actor Stephen Burkoff, who you might remember,
yes,
described Edmund Kean as, he was our greatest, our patron saint of the theater. Mm-hmm. He is the true tiger of the theater. Born in 1789, Kean was so great that apparently people would faint while watching. Like he was the Beatles or Frank Sinatra and the Bobby Sox.
Oh my God, what great acting.
Even Lord Byron.
Oh.
No shrinking violet. He was a tough guy.
Tough guy.
Even Lord Byron apparently actually passed out while watching Kean perform.
Maybe it's the ventilation in the theater. No, I'm just...
Now you're tearing things down out of your own insecurity. And by the way, I'd like a clean reading of the story because I may use this for the movie.
And start again.
So far, no, I can edit. Accounts differ somewhat, but from what I gather, Byron thought Kean was so unbelievable that he had a sword made and inscribed it to Kean.
Wow.
Who actually wore this sword while playing Richard III.
Mm-hmm.
It was treasured by Kean, and when he died at the age of 44,
wow, young,
in 1833, the sword was inherited by his son, Charles Kean, who gave it to Henry Irving, one of the great actor managers of the Victorian era,
mm-hmm,
especially at the Lyceum Theater.
Right.
Which is where we ended our shooting of Truth Is Out There.
That
we were at the Lyceum Pub, right across the street of the Lyceum Theater.
How about that, where Henry Irving performed?
Henry Irving is probably best known today as the inspiration for the title character in fellow Lyceum manager Bram Stoker's 1897 novel Dracula.
Ah, very good.
The sword was eventually given to the Terry family by Irving. Kate Terry was an actress and the grandmother of John Gielgud, who, of course, became one of the most respected actors of the 20th century. And so the sword was eventually bequeathed to him.
Right.
Here's where the story becomes symbolic of both continuity and artistic subjectivity. For the possession of the sword could be now traced to the greatest actors of the early 19th, late 19th, and early 20th centuries. And like any legend, this is where the details of various accounts begin to contradict. For it is said that it was in bequeathing the sword to Laurence Olivier, the greatest actor of the second half of the 20th century, that Gielgud had the sword engraved with an inscription, this sword given him by his mother Kate Terry Gielgud, 1938, is given to Laurence Olivier by his friend John Gielgud in appreciation of his performance of Richard III at the New Theater, 1944.
Okay.
That's one heck of an engraving
on
the sword.
That's a lot of words on there.
And there's no mention made of the supposed first engraving made by Byron for Kean.
Right. Okay.
Also, that engraving would certainly seem to imply that Gielgud was giving the sword to Olivier for good. Though all accounts state that Gielgud instructed Olivier to someday pass it along to a younger actor who excited and inspired him.
Right.
This never happened.
Right.
Not that Gielgud didn't instruct him that way, but certainly we know Olivier never did pass it along to a younger actor who excited and inspired him. Some say Olivier tried to find someone worthy of the sword, that he went to theaters to watch the likes of Richard Burton, Paul Scofield, Alec McCowan, but that upon dying he had never seen anybody who truly lived up to the standard required, someone that thrilled him. And so the sword remained in his possession after death. Others paint a more unforgiving portrait of Olivier's apparent ego.
That's the one I hear.
That when asked to whom he would give the sword, Olivier exclaimed, "No one, it's mine." What is known for certain is this, that like the pharaohs courting immortality through material possessions, during Olivier's memorial, Frank Finlay, who played Iago to Olivier's Othello,
yes,
carried the sword up the aisle at Westminster Abbey and placed it on the high altar, while echoing throughout the abbey was Olivier's recording of the St. Crispin's Day speech from Henry V.
Of course.
This was the last time the sword was ever seen in public. The date was 20 October 1989, exactly 84 years to the day from when Henry Irving himself was buried in the Abbey.
Ah.
Dean Hagland, explain to me how this indicates the way in which knowledge is lost.
Okay, so if he is not passing on this sword, so does it lose the direct physical contact with Keynes, with Henry Irving, with the history of British theater. And by him cutting that and just being buried with his sword, you have now lost all of that wisdom that you would pass on to a younger actor, whether you thought...
Right. The sword is symbolic of tradition.
Not
of
just
wisdom.
Symbolic. It is a physical contact of a lineage through time of a craft that then maybe that young actor then learns about Keynes and his amazing performance, learns about Irving, and brings all that forward.
And I thought your point, when you first brought this story to my attention, your point about, I think it was either the word ego or vanity, but right. This idea, you know, this question as we move forward and truth is out there, ancient mysteries, how is wisdom lost?
Right.
How is knowledge lost? Why is it lost? It's lost.
Because of vanity. Or because of ego.
That this man thought it should be buried with him.
Right.
He was the end of the line.
Right, and that all acting sucks now, and this is the end of our culture.
Or if it doesn't suck, it certainly doesn't live up to the standard it needs to be, which is, of course, defined as my standard.
Right, and that's the point. Had that sword been, that standard would have come up. I mean, you know, surely, even if it was sat with Richard Burton briefly... Then Kenneth Branagh or Ian McKellen, you know, surely one of these guys would have taken it on in our present day.
And I find this interesting also in the perspective of our present day, because one of the things I've certainly seen in corporate environments are people who will not share their knowledge.
Yes.
Sometimes out of fear that they will be replaced. I mean, what kind of vanity or ego are we talking about that would allow someone to be buried with that kind of tradition, to think no one lives up to my standards? It's not a knowledge that
right.
No one will live up to the standards. It's a fear of being forgotten.
Of course.
It's a fear of being exceeded.
Yeah.
No one will be greater than me.
I have to be the greatest.
Right.
Yeah.
And we see this in the corporate workplace a lot.
A ton.
People who won't share ideas. Because as long as they are the only ones who know this, they are irreplaceable.
Right.
Whereas I was always taught, and again, this is great advice, no matter what business you're pursuing, what where you find yourself working, what kind of project, you are only as valuable as your ability to be replaced.
Mm.
Have you prepared people for the possibility that you will not be there? You might not be into work because of a sickness.
Right.
You might be called away for any variety of issues. You may die. You may leave the job.
Right.
Don't you want the environment in which you work to flourish after you are there?
Right.
Ego and vanity and fear prevents you from doing that. It prevents the knowledge from being passed even today in these settings. So that's what I find very interesting about your point of view on
right.
This.
So, and the counterpoint then?
Well, the counterpoint of this is that the story indicates how knowledge is not lost. In fact, my point of view is all that was lost was a sword.
Which is a direct physical line. I mean, it's like a historical artifact.
Only an artifact was lost. So long as the story of that artifact remains alive, the knowledge is not lost.
Okay.
And in fact, I would say that the reason we're telling this story is because Olivier willfully withheld it. If he had passed it on, we might not even know about the sword. We certainly might not know who has it.
Right, that's true.
We care about it because we know about it, and we care about it because Olivier did not pass it on. And in so doing, he passed along a story of the tradition of theater that resonates with us thousands of miles and several decades away.
Yeah.
And at a time on this planet when one human language is going extinct every 2 weeks.
Right.
We lose a human language every 2 weeks when the last practitioner of that language dies.
Right.
When a language dies, the stories that are uniquely told through that language and uniquely understood through that language die with it.
Right.
And it's through these stories that the unique perspectives, the unique knowledge of a people are passed on.
Right.
So as long as stories are told, as long as they resonate, as long as they are passed on, I say knowledge is never truly lost, even if objects
fall to the wayside.
Might be lost.
Might be lost. Okay, interesting. I'll give you that. I still say he's a dick. I'm sorry.
Well, what a lovely note to end on, Dean Haglund.
Thank you. And that, as always...
What an interesting installment.
So interesting.
Of your Chilpack Hollywood Hour.
Like all Chilpack Hollywood's Hour. Very interesting.
I mean, Shakespearean history.
And...
The importance
lawsuits.
Of languages, violence prevention, student performers.
That's right.
Pursuing what you love.
Underwhelming chandelier crashes. All of these things.
Well, you really don't like to deal strictly in the positive, do you?
I do. That's my favorite part is an underwhelming chandelier crash. I think that's very positive. You can find every episode of the Chilpack Hollywood
Hour. No, as we've already discussed,
not
you can
every.
Find
many episodes.
Many episodes of your Chilpack Hollywood
the
Hour.
The good ones.
Oh my God. At chilpackhollywood.com, C-H-I-L-L-P-A-K, Hollywood.com. You can download them. You can stream them. You
can subscribe
via iTunes and really simple syndication.
It's so easy.
Become a liker of the show on Facebook.
Like us.
Facebook.com/chilpackhollywood. Write us.
Yes.
ChillpackHollywood@yahoo.com. We read these emails ourselves. These are the ones especially that end up on the show. We try, if you write us on Facebook or tweet or text us, to include them. But the easiest ones for us to remember, because we cut and paste them right into the notes for the show,
easy,
are from ChillpackHollywood@yahoo.com.
Yep.
Follow Dean Haglund on Twitter.
At D. Haglund.
I'm Phil Larenas. Come and see us. Sunday, April 15th, Sacramento, movies on a big screen.
Movies on a big screen.
You can find the details, moviesonabigscreen.com. We'll be there with The Truth Is Out There. Till next week, I'm Phil Laird.
I'm Dean Haglund.
Belated spoiler alert.